It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you've noticed lots of retail marketing emails in your inbox advertising big sales or the perfect looks for all your at-home needs, you're not alone. We'll talk about shopping during the coronavirus outbreak. If you're listening right now, you play a vital role in funding the programs you're passionate about. Whatever your reason for giving, interesting conversations, in-depth news, inspiring music, this spring member drive is your time to support the service you rely on. Make your gift at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552, or give. Now, on a day in Wisconsin where pools are closed for health reasons and outside it's either snowing or about to, swimming may not be on everybody's minds. But for people cooped up at home looking forward to a summer of safely reopened public waters, pools, and water parks can actually be satisfying and calming. Our next guest has spent a lot of time thinking and writing about the benefits of being in and around the water and why we humans like it so much. Bonnie Tsui is a contributor to the New York Times and California Sunday Magazine. She lives, surfs, and swims in the Bay Area. Her new book, out today, is called Why We Swim. Bonnie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, what is it about water and swimming that's so appealing to a species that evolved to, you know, run around on the land?
I think that there are so many wonderful reasons why the water is resonant for us. And one of my favorite writers, Florence Williams, a science writer, she describes it as the fact that we humans are programmed to have respond to set points in the environment, which means green spaces and blue places especially. And so, you know, even though we have to be taught, we're weird in that way. We're amongst terrestrial mammals in that we don't have instinctive swimming ability from birth. We have to be taught and we have to learn it. And so I think in some ways, on some level, that is makes it all the more valuable and special to us.
Can you share, Bonnie, a little of your personal story about your connection to swimming?
Well, my parents have a meet cute, which is that they met in a swimming pool in Hong Kong. And so it's kind of my family's origin story. He was a lifeguard and she was a swimmer. And because of them, I have swum my entire life. I grew up in New York, Queens, and Long Island. And I learned to swim from a very young age. I was on the swim team. I became a lifeguard just like my dad and so did my brother. And we just had a lifelong relationship with the water. And, you know, over time, over the years, that role has evolved. I started to notice that after I had kids, that, you know, I swam through each of my pregnancies and right up until the day both my sons were born. Now they're 7 and 9 and they have just joined the swim team. And so, you know, it's just been amazing to watch them learn to swim and kind of ask myself what it means to me to be observing that in the stories we tell ourselves about swimming in water.
Talk about the swimming mind. It's really a unique thing. I've just gotten into swimming for real over the last year, and of course now I can't get to pools, but there is something different about swimming than anything else I've done, and I can't put words to it. You've put a lot of words to it. Can you tell us what's unique about our brains while we swim?
Well, you know, it's so much about how we respond to the sensory input of water, from the way it looks to the way it sounds to the way it feels. And our brains just change. You know, we have, alpha waves that kind of are in response to the all of that sensory input and the calming effect. And we kind of lose the scatteredness, I think about when I go into the water, I'm kind of twitchy, you know, and then I ease myself in and I start swimming, and about 5 or 10 minutes in, all of that is sort of washed away. And I kind of have a pacing to my thinking and to just my breathing, you know, it's all integrated into then, how my mind is allowed to wander and kind of make connections that are different from when I'm on land.
we hear a lot about mindfulness, and I could see that happening while we swim. You know, we focus on our breath and our heart rate and things like that. But one of the people you talk to, I think it was a swimming coach, talks about cultivating mindlessness while swimming. What is that?
Right. Well, it's a practice of, you know, I think he's talking about really is a presentness. And we are so distracted by, you know, different stimuli at all times that we can't really focus. And so when he talks about mindlessness, it's that you've trained yourself to, you know, such a degree that your actions are automatic. So you don't think about the physical reality of moving yourself through the water. Obviously you are on some level, you're it's practiced. And so one part of the brain is taken up with that, but it's not the front, you know, at the front and center of your consciousness. And in that way, it's very relaxing. You know, you can kind of allow yourself, once you get to a certain point of your ability and facility with the water and be comfortable, that it just allows you to be free. And I think we all know that. I think we've all known that since we were kids.
We're talking to Bonnie Tsui about her new book, Why We Swim. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know why you swim, or if you're a swimmer, what appeals about the water to you? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Bonnie, you share some stories of people who do things I would consider fairly extreme, swimming across the Bering Strait, for example. And some people have, I don't know, special physical adaptations that make them better in the water. Sometimes it's nature, sometimes it's nurture. Can you talk about some of what you found out by meeting some of these people?
Oh, sure. Well, the first and foremost in the opening of the book is an Icelandic fisherman named Gudlaugur Friðþórsson. Oh my gosh, yeah, he is just, there's a reason I opened the book with his story. So he, and you know, the story is that he fell overboard, his fishing vessel capsized one winter night in 1984, and everyone else died pretty quickly, 41 degree water, it was cold, you basically have 20 to 30 minutes max. And he ended up swimming for 6 hours to safety. And when he got out of the water, he had to, you know, he made his way to help and got to the hospital. And it turned out that he did not suffer from any signs of hypothermia, which is just impossible when you think about it for a normal person. And he was just a little bit dehydrated. And it turned out that he has this biological quirk that was just his fat layer was much more resembling of a seal's than a human's. And it's like 2 to 3 times human thickness. And he was able to keep his core warm and stable, and he just kept swimming. And he was a great swimmer. He, you know, trained in the Maritime Academy, and he, those two things saved him.
That, and that's something that he didn't try to get, I guess, but you also write that some people have a different water superpower. They see really well underwater, and we can actually, that can come from just early exposure and lots of swimming early on.
That's exactly right. I mean, it does sound a little bit crazy, but there are some sort of research studies that have shown with kids who, you know, grow up in sort of water environments, water cultures where they grow up, you know, free diving for shellfish and all that, that they have this ability from a young age to focus on objects underwater very clearly, the way that most of us, we know we go underwater, our corneas are just not, you know, suited to, it's very blurry. And, right. And then something changes with our focal, you know, our focal point, our focal fields, when you, the muscles in your eyes have been trained over time, and you can do that. You can train yourself to do it. They have found that, even when you haven't, grown up in those environments.
We're talking to Bonnie Tsui about her new book. It's called Why We Swim. And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Big part of your life, or maybe your kids' life. What does it mean to you to get into the water? Are you missing it right now? If you had regularly attended, gone to a pool and it's closed right now, what plans do you have for swimming when orders get lifted, or fresh water gets, warm enough to want to swim in, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with author and swimmer Bonnie Tsui. We're talking about her new book, Why We Swim. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you swim, why do you swim? How did you get into it? Have you ever done it competitively? Do you do it for fun? Pools, lakes? Are you missing stress relief right about now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know why you swim. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go to your calls. Carrie is going to start us off. Carrie is calling from Madison. Carrie, hello.
Hello. I love to swim, and I like to swim at night after everybody else has left the pool. The condos where I live have a couple of pools, and I'll be there in the evening and read until everybody leaves, and then I'll swim. And last year, my sister gave me some kind of a device with earplugs so I can swim to music. So I swim to Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson and Amazing Grace, and I just love it. But I'm worried about this summer not being able to swim.
Carrie, thanks a lot for that call. So Carrie likes that solitary swimming, Bonnie, and you talk about both solitary and kind of community swimming. Can you talk about the appeal, first of all, of just getting that water to yourself for a little while?
Yeah, you know, what I really found over the course of the book was that solitariness, that solitude is really rare, increasingly rare these days. Well, at least from a psychological standpoint, right now we're isolating from each other, but we are still barraged with connectivity, right? It's the way that we are communicating with each other, and it's actually, you know, more so now. And so, sort of in more normal times, that to be able to slip into the water is to find some quiet. And so I think that is so essential and so appealing. And when you start making it a daily practice, a regular practice, that it is, you realize that you need it and it's so beneficial to you. But of course, there's the community aspect too, with the teams and with your, you know, the people you see at the pool or in the open water where you tend to frequent. And that's really valuable too, because that's just your social, that, you know, it's your tribe. And I think all of us swimmers know that we have a tribe.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Chris now in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was a really good swimmer. My mother insisted that we take swimming lessons from the time we were like 4 or 5 years old. And I became a very good swimmer. And I went through my senior life savings certificate. I took my final exam, which is swimming a mile in Elkhart Lake in October on a windy day. It was awful. But what I wanted to say is that I can no longer do that because I have MS and fibromyalgia, and I can't be a great swimmer anymore. I just don't have the wherewithal. But if you are disabled in some way, getting into a warm pool and being able to just do your thing, whatever it is you can do, is really beneficial because it gets your cardio going a little bit and because you can't fall down, because I can't go running or walking because I'll fall down and you can't hurt yourself.
Chris, right. Thanks a lot for that call. And Bonnie, that reminds me of an anecdote you shared. I think you actually closed the book with that. Somebody who had been a big swimmer, had a major health problem, but still found ways to get back into the water. Can you share that with us?
Yeah. And I just wanted to respond to our caller that the healing aspect of water, and especially warm water, well, and also cold water, but warm water, just how it feels and how buoying it is and how soothing it is and how much it removes, you know, the burden of a lot of physical ailments for a lot of people, that really cannot be discounted. It is so essential. I've actually gotten a lot of letters from people in this period that we have not been able to go swimming, that they, you know, they miss their daily tonic, you know, that's how they talk about it. And especially for people who are older, who for whatever reason, you know, for that land is just not the exercise for them, that the pool is the place where they are able to, you know, leave all that behind and be free. And in the book, actually, I talked to a bunch of researchers, especially longevity specialists, who say that swimming is just so great for example, arthritis sufferers, that just swimming itself actually helps their mobility and strength and pain management, even when they're out of the water. And so that is really amazing. And they've just gotten a bunch of published research on that in the last couple of years. It's pretty new. And so it's kind of affirming what we already have known for a long time.
Thanks a lot for that call, Chris, at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jocelyn is with us in Sheboygan. Jocelyn, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Jocelyn?
I'm trying to condense all the things that I want to say so they don't take up too much time. But I'm not a great swimmer, but I'm a great floater. And I absolutely love being in the water. One of the things that I really like about swimming is the stretch that you can get, you know, along the front of your body that you can't really get any other way. You're just, the water supports you, and you can just get this amazing stretch from your toes to the top of your head. I love that. And I also I never thought I would swim in Lake Michigan, even though I lived in Sheboygan most of my life. A friend, you know, kind of dragged me in, you know, I was complaining about it, but once I got in there and started enjoying it, I couldn't believe how wonderful it was to just have that, you know, the waves, they just kind of like relax your whole body. And the last time I swam in Lake Michigan, it was getting towards the end of the season, and I was in there for like 2.5 hours, and I had to literally make myself get out.
Fantastic. Jocelyn, thanks for the call. Bonnie, what do you think?
I mean, I feel you. I am all about that. And I think that just the rhythm, you know, especially with an open body of water where you have wind, you have, you know, some waves and some feeling, some sense of connection to the larger world. I mean, I think when I am in the Pacific Ocean, I get out there in the morning and I just look and I think how lucky I am, and the sense of scale and the sense of perspective, everything does fall away in a way that is, like I said, just so, so wonderful and so rare these days.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Bonnie Tsui. Her new book is called Why We Swim. Back to your calls now. Ben is with us in Marshall. Ben, hi.
Yeah, I was not a good swimmer, but I was on the swim team. But I spent 12 years or more than that coaching diving and everything. I would wake up at 6 in the morning because I had bathrooms, and I'd grab a bunch of raspberries from my garden and then run to the pool, like, be at work at 6 in less than a minute, and then spend the, like, coach the diving team, keep swimming, like, whatever. It's like, this program is just fun. This is like bringing back so many old memories of my life as a swim coach and a diving coach. Thank you.
Ben, thanks for the call. Bonnie, I bet you've heard from a lot of people who just, you know, you're reminding them of their fond memories of swimming and diving and just time in the water.
It makes me so happy to hear these stories. And one of the reasons that I loved writing this book so much, and now after it's being published today, that I am so looking forward to and have been enjoying, is that everyone has a swimming story. No matter whether or not they call themselves a swimmer, they might say, I'm not that good a swimmer. And you'll see, as in this half an hour that we were just talking, that that there's something really singular and healing and wonderful and buoying about being in the water that I think we can all really look forward to on the other side of this.
We also heard from Rhoda in La Crosse. She wanted to ask about the link between swimming and the sensation in the womb. And you write a little bit about that, Bonnie, I know.
Well, it is such a funny, I mean, we can only surmise what we remember from being in the womb, but just the, you know, that you have, I mean, you hear your mother's voice when you're in the womb as a baby who's growing. And I think when you're in the water, in the pool, you know, it's a muffling effect that you hear some people talking, maybe, and there's sort of like a whooshing. And there's something that I think people find very comforting about that. And I think that's why when they go walk to the ocean and people are so drawn to the beach and they're drawn to places where there is running water, they love waterfalls. Like, there is something about that sound quality that is immediately soothing. And once you come out of the womb, you know, anyone who has a small child will know that when they go, you know, rushing water sounds or, you know, ocean waves, they can use that on Spotify or actually go to a place where there is water that will soothe your baby. And I think that there's something very human about that response.
Hey, you know, you mentioned that. Can we do that for ourselves, not just our baby? Since we can't get in the water in a lot of cases right now, can we trick our brains into feeling like we're waterborne for a little bit?
You know, apparently so. I'm sure your readers, your listeners know about Wallace J. Nichols and Blue Mind. And so he's such an evangelist and author of a book about that exact thing where, and now he's been talking about, you know, even though you can't get into your pool or the water, the body that you love, it is still really valuable to look at water, to experience it virtually, he calls it domestic waters, meaning, you know, in your home, like a bath or a shower or just looking at pictures or like watching something. I mean, you could watch Blue Planet, you know, it is something that is calming to us. And so even that kind of sensory input that is virtual is very useful and, you know, good for us at this time.
Bonnie, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, Rob. I had a great time.
That's swimmer and author Bonnie Tsui. We talked to her about her new book, Why We Swim. It is out today. We are in our spring member drive. WPR makes a difference in your day. It keeps you connected with news, culture, and swimming from nearby and far away. You can support these programs with a gift now. Call in at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Or give at WPR.org. And thank you. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Listener support is the largest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio. That's a big deal. This spring member drive, support the programs you value. Give now at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552 or give online at WPR.org. And thank you. Coming up, Judge Jill Karofsky was declared the winner last night in Wisconsin's Supreme Court race, unseating incumbent Justice Dan Kelly. We'll look at what happened and talk about the rest of the results from the state's spring election. Now, the JCPenney Corporation is celebrating 118 years since its first store opened this week amid a lot of uncertainty in the retail world. In fact, a lot of email inboxes might be full of messages from businesses big and small, like Penny's, competitively advertising big sales and using timely subject lines about our current situation. But for some, shopping for those non-essential items right now can feel a little bit odd and not in everybody's budget right now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been doing more online shopping than usual right now? Are you trying to find ways to support local, smaller businesses at this moment? If you're a warehouse worker or delivery person, how has this impacted you? Call 800-642-1234. Felicia Miller is an associate professor and chair of the marketing department at Marquette University. Felicia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, these are unusual times in many regards, I think, including shopping. Felicia, do you think we're seeing a big turn where maybe a lot of people who didn't shop online in the past are giving it a try now?
I think there's definitely going to be an increase in the number of consumers who are going to be doing online shopping. I think part of it is, for some people, they don't have any alternative. And so at this point, e-commerce is the only way that, in some cases, they can get essential things that they need as well as non-essentials. I think the other piece of it is you know, people are trying different things, a lot more of, you know, click and pick experiences where you go online, you fill out a form of what groceries you may need and have them delivered to your house, or you pull up and somebody puts them in the back of your car. So I think there's a lot of people who are finding new ways to deal with this pandemic.
We sometimes hear about people having this concept of retail therapy, even in normal times. You had a bad week, you're anxious, you go to a store and buy something. And I've read some essays anyway that people are seeing that as maybe being risky right now. There's a lot of anxiety and a lot of tempting online things trying to get us to buy stuff. Is there a concern that consumers might go overboard in response to that kind of marketing in these tough times?
I do think that is a cautionary tale that we need to think about, because a lot of companies, particularly car companies, are doing a lot of deep, deep discounting on cars with very low, if any, interest rates. And for now, that seems great. But what happens, you know, 2-3 months from now, hopefully, when this is all over, then you're sort of in a different financial situation than you thought you would be.
As consumers, we know our dollars help keep a store open. And I know some people are worried, well, if I'm buying from a big company, say Amazon, that might be stuff that I usually would have spent for, you know, the local business across the street or across town. Is there a concern that in this time we're going to see, obviously it's big trouble. Are we going to see a lot of big problems for smaller businesses because of that?
Well, I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is, you know, big e-commerce platforms like Amazon, a great deal of the products that they sell come from smaller companies. They're using Amazon as a marketplace to get their products to consumers that they couldn't do on their own. And so I think we should be cautious in thinking that, you know, well, I'll just stop buying things, because it not only is going to impact the large companies, but it's also going to impact a lot of small companies that rely on e-commerce to get their products to their consumers.
Talking to Felicia Miller, associate professor and chair of the marketing department at Marquette University, looking at the way we shop, changes maybe in the way we shop during this coronavirus pandemic, with a lot of stores closed or at best operating a little differently than usual, a lot of people seeking out online alternatives. Felicia, I've seen some people, again, in online essays raising concerns about the ethics of shopping online. Concerns, for example, of the well-being of the delivery people, the warehouse workers. Is that something we should be worried about, do you think?
We absolutely should be concerned about those types of things. Most companies, large and small, have a significant code of ethics in terms of not only how they interact with their consumers, but how they interact with their employees. And so we can be hopeful that those terms are still in place. And we've even seen some advertising where companies are underscoring the things that they're doing to protect their employees. And so I think that is something we have to be vigilant about, but I think companies are going above and above beyond to try to communicate what they're doing to keep their workers safe.
I'll share a personal example of my shopping. I'm a big nerd for board games, and I saw a handful of publishers are saying if you order directly from us and give us the name of your local store, we'll give them the cut of the profits they usually would have gotten to help them stay online. Are you seeing that kind of creative solution out there, those sort of creative partnerships along those lines?
I haven't seen it in that particular industry, but I have seen some collaboration happening amongst restaurants where they've consolidated instead of having two or three different locations, that they're all sort of working together. And there's a very heavy reliance on delivery services for food right now, because some people just don't want to cook, aren't able to cook, or they just don't want to leave their homes for safety purposes. And so I have seen, you know, within the food and beverage industry, some of that type of collaboration.
I started off talking about JCPenney, and they're one of the big kind of a landmark mall retailers. They've been around for a long time, and they've seen big struggles in recent years. A lot of stores along those lines have either closed multiple outlets or gone bankrupt altogether or are facing other struggles. Do you see this potentially being a last straw for some of those, you know, names that we're all pretty familiar with?
I think there's a handful of names that we all know and have been around for a very long time and have been struggling well before all of the coronavirus came along. And so I don't think that this helps them for sure. And it probably in some cases hastens their imminent failure as a company and their inability to continue to provide services to consumers. On the other side, I do think that the situation has created a great deal of opportunity for people who want to start a small business or to, you know, expand a business. They are finding ways to be more creative in offering consumers things that they didn't previously have access to. So even though, you know, the economy is in really bad shape right now, we need to realize that eventually things are going to get better, and we need to have, you know, an infrastructure of various types of retail to support, you know, that environment that ultimately will come back.
For smaller businesses, I know some of them have been, before even this outbreak, some have been really innovative and creative in their online marketing. You know, you might see the brick and mortar store and half their business might be online. Do you think this is going to be an incentive for more retailers, maybe even small manufacturers, to seek out ways to do that, to make sure they have that online presence?
I think so. I think there are a number of companies who were late to the game with online shopping, and this gives them another chance to kind of catch up and do some online marketing that's not as expensive as a large company. I mean, we see Walmart probably 3-4 ads a day, but for smaller companies, it's an opportunity for them to get their products out. And a time when consumers are looking for something a little bit different. They're at home, they're with their loved ones, and they're looking for ways to make that time more meaningful for them.
As we start to wrap up, Felicia, what are you watching for? There's a lot going on here. Is there any particular thing you are really keyed in on right now when it comes to stores, retail, online or in person?
I think the bottom line is going to be that, you know, online was already growing at a very rapid pace. That's going to continue to happen. And frankly, we're going to need consumers at some point to come back into the marketplace and ensure that we have the things that we want and need once this pandemic is starting to taper off. Because if we aren't continuing to support these companies now, they may not be there for us in the future.
Felicia, thanks a lot for being with us again today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Felicia Miller is an associate professor of marketing at Marquette University. She joined us to talk about online shopping, in-person shopping, and more during the COVID-19 outbreak. Coming up, Wisconsin got results from the spring election yesterday after just shy of a week since some voters went to the polls in the middle of the outbreak. We'll break down who won, who didn't, and what it means for the future. Stay with us. We've got more coming here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up with stay-at-home orders in place and uncertainty over when the coronavirus pandemic will start to end, gardening has become a popular way of escaping the chaotic times. We'll look at the therapeutic qualities of working with soil. Now, Wisconsin held its spring election last week in the midst of the coronavirus outbreak. Last night, we got our first look at the results. In the big race, the race for the state Supreme Court, the liberal-backed Judge Jill Karofsky beat out incumbent Justice Dan Kelly, who is supported by conservatives. And former Vice President Joe Biden easily defeated Senator Bernie Sanders, who withdrew from the primary race between Election Day and Election Result Day. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of multiple books on political science, including as co-author Mad Men and Politics, Nostalgia, and the Remaking of Modern America. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on today, Rob.
Let's look at the big result here in Wisconsin for our state Supreme Court seat for Jill Karofsky. Can you talk about how big a change this is and what it means down the road?
Well, again, this was, you know, a sort of tumultuous election last week, and the outcome spread of, you know, 10 points between Kelly and Karofsky. And Kelly is the incumbent. Incumbents generally have an advantage in incumbency. And in this case, that did not proved to be the case. And there's a whole bunch of discussion with regard to the difference also in the vote outcomes for the primaries, the presidential preference primaries, in terms of the Democrats having a contested primary between Biden and Sanders and Trump running essentially unopposed, and whether or not that also depressed some of the voters who might otherwise have come out if that Republican nomination had been contested.
That said, I saw some national and international reporting on our election here that talked about a, you know, an upset win, a surprise or shocking win, whereas I felt like people in Wisconsin were looking at this thing saying, we have no idea, given all the hullabaloo here, what's going to come out of this. Which way do you lean?
I was leaning in the latter way, in the latter direction, because it was, you know, as you say, I love the word choice, a hullabaloo. And also, you know, somewhat disconcerting when you have, you know, shelter in place and stay at home orders around the country, around the world. And then you have the sort of demand that in order to vote, you actually have to go and be in public with other people. And we all saw the images of people standing 6 feet apart from each other in line, and so forth. And it taking hours and hours in Green Bay and Milwaukee to vote. And so it was quite tumultuous. And I didn't know how many people would end up voting. And so we see quite a few people did end up voting, both absentee and in person. And we had fairly robust voter turnout. 34%, I think, is the percentage of eligible voters who came in one form or another, voted by mail or voted in person last Tuesday.
I want to give a listen to Justice-elect Karofsky and her victory speech over Zoom last night, talking here about voters deciding last week whether to go to the polls or stay home.
The people in the state rose up. They fought through that untenable decision, and they decided that they want to have Supreme Court justices who make decisions based on what the law is, who are not beholden to special interests, who are not partisan. And that's what you're going to have in Justice Jill Karofsky.
Now, Lily, this is a common theme in this Supreme Court race and past Supreme Court races. If I'm the candidate, I'm going to observe the rule of law, and my opponent is beholden to partisan special interests. And that's what we hear from candidates on both sides.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the oddity of voting in judicial races, and not everybody does. We do it here in the state of Wisconsin, but other states, they're appointed by governors in a fashion that's to some degree more like the federal fashion. But, you know, we do have these 10-year terms, which is also supposed to make them less partisan, more independent on the bench. So it is definitely a complicated kind of thinking when you also are sort of saying the person running is supposed to be nonpartisan, but it's clear that one person is going to be more like a Republican and one person is going to be more like a Democrat.
Now, after an election like this, the moment the results are out, we start trying to figure out, okay, does this mean something for a future election in November or 2023 for the next state Supreme Court election? I don't know. Seems like it's going to be hard to hang a lot of valid predictions given the weirdness of this one. What do you think, Lily?
I mean, I think I would agree with you that because of the complicated nature of, you know, what happened with the various court rulings being made and then being overturned and you know, at the sort of we're at peak coronavirus in Wisconsin right now, as I understand it, and I'm not an epidemiologist, and so I'm not sure. An expert in any of those aspects, but I think that it is a very complicated sort of what can we draw out from this particular election that might tell us about November or might tell us about future elections, because it was quite tumultuous.
Talking to Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, talking about last week's election and yesterday's election results in various races here in the state. Let's turn to the Democratic presidential primary. Lily, technically, voters had a choice. There were a bunch of names on the ballot, only by last Tuesday, a couple of them still actually in the race. Can we make too much of what we saw in the results yesterday? Because it looked like Joe Biden was going to be the nominee no matter what Wisconsin said.
And again, you know, and this is a major reversal from what we saw in Wisconsin 4 years ago with regard to Sanders doing quite well and winning Wisconsin 4 years ago. Last week's election, Biden carried the majority in every county in Wisconsin on the Democratic side of the ticket. So that was a real switch in terms of the outcome. And as we know, Senator Sanders suspended his campaign the day after the Wisconsin primary last week, and then recently endorsed Vice President Biden. And so you do have, you know, 32% of the voters who voted in the Democratic primary voted for Sanders. 2%, in fact, voted for Elizabeth Warren, but 63% voted for Joe Biden. And he is the presumptive nominee now for the Democratic Party.
Looking ahead to November, Lily, I won't ask you to make big predictions, but this one I think is safe. Wisconsin will be hotly contested and one of a handful of states that could swing the whole thing. Is that fair to say?
I would say that is fair to say.
Now, looking at how we do elections a little bit, I don't know. Do you think we need to do more to think about, hey, elections are a big deal and things can happen, natural disasters, pandemics, cyber attacks or whatever? Do we need to have more plan Bs in our pocket?
I mean, I would think so. And you know, I think the assembly just voted and did not pass a number of proposals for more sort of absentee or mail-in voting opportunities for the November election. There are a number of states that do complete mail-in balloting on the West Coast, Washington and Oregon. And I think Colorado has also been doing it now, too, for not quite as long. But if you remember, in 2012, there was a giant hurricane blizzard that hit along the East Coast. And it was the same sort of situation that just days before the presidential election, there was massive structural damage and people without power in New York and Connecticut and New Jersey and so forth. And so I think that, you know, trying to protect the process is important so that people have the capacity to vote if there is a pandemic, if there is a hurricane, a flood, whatever.
As we start to wrap up, Lily, any other takeaways that you've been thinking about from last Tuesday / yesterday's results of last Tuesday?
That in the races that the Sanders Biden race actually drew more votes than the Karofsky race in terms of the votes that she carried and how many votes they carried combined. And also there was quite substantial absentee voting, particularly in Milwaukee, Waukesha, and Washington counties. And I know that was part of the complication was people had requested absentee ballots and they hadn't gotten one. I actually had a friend who received one, but it was the wrong ballot. So there were a whole bunch of different things that transpired. People can get the ballots back in time. I know there were questions about postmarks. And so the question of having people have enough time to request ballots and then mail them in by the time the election is, I think, sort of important and something that both we should think about at the state, local, and national level.
Lily, thanks a lot for being with us again today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That's Lily Gorin with Carroll University with us today to talk about the results released last night for the state's spring election and what it could mean as election season continues on now to November. If you want more about the results and specific races, find them at WPR.org. Listener support is the biggest piece of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a really big deal. We heard from one listener from Madison who made a gift and said, thank you for keeping people informed. That's a lot of what we try to do here. Well, this spring, member drives support the programs that you value Give now at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Today is April 14th, or 4/14, and some Milwaukee area residents are celebrating it as Milwaukee Day, since that matches their 414 area code. I see a lot of people are sharing their love of Milwaukee with images, videos, and more on social media using the hashtag 414Day. That made me think about Wisconsin's other area codes and whether they can celebrate days of their own. That led me to a shocking discovery that shook my grasp on reality. First, let's take a look at the big area codes around the state. 608, South and Western Wisconsin, they got June 8th, no problem. 715, the big area code in Central and Northern Wisconsin, 715, July 15th. 920 in Eastern Wisconsin, September 20th. But the 262 in the southeastern part of the state, there's no February 62nd, unless we have a really big leap year someday. But then the shocking discovery, I take it as an article of faith that Wisconsin has exactly 5 area codes, and working on call-in shows all these years, I know them by heart. Except area code maps show 2 more area codes in Wisconsin. They were added, or supposed to be added apparently, as overlays for regions that were running out of numbers, meaning that same region would have 2 area codes. Area code 534 in the 715 region and 274 in the 920. Apologies if you live there and already know this, but this is new to me. If you have a number at 534 or 274, call in right now so we can see it on our caller ID. You don't even have to say anything. The truth is out there. This is Central Time.